This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The program Mad Men made TV history last night at the Emmy Awards when it became the first basic cable show to win for Outstanding Drama Series. The creator of the show, Matthew Weiner, also won an Emmy for Outstanding Writing for a Drama Series. Weiner is my guest, along with two stars of the show, John Hamm and John Slattery, who were Emmy nominees. Mad Men is set in the early 1960s at the fictional advertising agency Sterling Cooper, which is run by white Anglo-Saxon Protestant men who drink, smoke, and womanize. The show revolves around the ad campaigns the agency comes up with and the personal lives of the people who work at the agency. John Hamm plays Don Draper, the most creative person at the agency. John Slattery plays Roger Sterling, who rose through the agency because his father co-founded it. Matthew Weiner was an executive producer and writer for The Sopranos before Mad Men. Let's start with a scene from this season, the show's second. The agency is working on an ad campaign for Playtex bras, which has been emphasizing comfort, but is considering playing to women's fantasies like its rival Maidenform does. Kinsey, a young associate, suggests that they play to the idea that all women see themselves as either a Jackie Kennedy, or a Marilyn Monroe. Peggy, who has risen in the agency from secretary to copywriter, isn't so sure.
I don't know if all women are a Jackie or a Marilyn. Maybe men see them that way.
Bras are for men. Women want to see themselves the way men see them.
You're a Jackie or a Marilyn. A line and a curve. Nothing goes better together.
Which do you think I am?
Gertrude Stein.
I would say you're more classical. Helena.
Irene Dunne.
Oh, I love Irene Dunne.
Peggy, you're going to have company on this. Congratulations, Kinsey. Forced your way onto an account.
Matthew Weiner, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's great to be here, Terry.
And we'll meet John Hamm and John Slattery in a second. Let's start with the scene that we just heard. You know, it's all these men deciding what will make women buy a bra and assuming that they know.
Yeah, exactly.
What made you think about using a bra campaign?
That episode is it's kind of a special episode. It's really about how we perceive ourselves and how we're perceived by other people. And there was this idea from the beginning that we were going to talk about pantyhose, which had just come out and really kind of revolutionized everything because they were preferred by working women and by women in general, but they were really reviled by men and didn't catch on right away, and they were very expensive. And then we started talking about the, you know, most products, consumer products, are bought by women. And, of course, most people in advertising are men. And there is an idea where you start to realize that the way that women perceive themselves is going to be dictated by men if that's the marketing campaign. And, of course, Peggy is put on all of the campaigns, as they would do, you know, find a woman to deal with food and home-related things and underwear. But at the same time, her opinion is not really as valuable as the men. So the bra just became a perfect sort of example. And we had established that Playtex was one of their clients. And, you know, I'm always interested in where's the boundary, at which point where men can stop speaking for women.
In a way, bras are like the invisible star of the show because a lot of the actresses seem to be wearing those kind of pointy padded bullet bras that were a mainstay of Hollywood in the 50s and early 60s.
Well, yeah, they are. I mean, Janie Bryant, our costume designer, I mean, I insisted that everything be accurate. But what we started talking about is that the silhouette of a woman's body, they could change it every year as the styles changed by just altering the underwear. Now it's all determined by exercise. So there is no need for foundation garments now because if a woman – if you do yoga, you have a yoga body, the clothes are made for a yoga body. So, and for breast implants and for all these other things that have happened to women's bodies in the last few years.
And if you don't have a yoga body, it's hard to find anything to fish you.
Exactly. And we have that on the show even with those period pieces. But the underwear is, I mean, when you get to the point and you think about women burning their bras, it really becomes a much more elaborate thing. I mean, just, I wrote it into the show, just the actresses would have to go to the bathroom and you'd have to have 25 minutes. And you're like, what is going on? And they're like, you do not know what is going on down there. There's so much stuff to take off and put on. And it's really about taking whatever body you have and physically molding it into the silhouette that was in style at that time.
Mad Men is so absorbed in the period of the 1950s, the fashions, the advertising, the kind of home life people were expected to have. You were born in 1965, just a few years after Mad Men is set. Why are you so absorbed in the period of the early 60s?
I think that it's a golden era, the 50s, for the United States, and not just economically, but they just discovered this thing about product obsolescence, and so they realized that besides making products crappier to get people to buy a new – you could get people to buy a new washing machine every 3 years instead of every 7 years by just making it look better or by giving it a new color. So there's this whole design thing that happens, and there's also kind of an open-mindedness after the war when people came home. Which we don't see it that way because the advertising and the movies sort of have this conservative bent to them. And we think of the dad with his smoking his pipe driving in the car and that sort of, you know, that advertising image of America. But what was really going on is if you look at the bestsellers and the movies, there's a real subversive element to it and a real, whether it's Catch-22 or, you know, Norman Mailer, you know, there's a, you know, Arthur Miller, these aspects of the 50s, of the intellectual part of the 50s, had really permeated the culture and were very popular. I think part of it is that the economic needs had been met by people and they started thinking about other things. But everything that happened in the 60s really started happening in the 50s. And my parents were steeped in that. And they got married in 1959. And my dad's a scientist and they're both from New York and they're bourgeois American Jews. But their values are like very, you know, they were obsessed with Hemingway and the Blacklist and intolerance, and they have great politics, and being an intellectual was not frowned upon. You know, they'd come out of the McCarthy era, and that was like the worst thing in the world. So that's sort of something that I kind of always identified with that.
What was the germ of the idea for Mad Men? What came to you first?
I wanted to do something about what I consider to be the people who run the country, who were raised in the Great Depression and had childhoods that were kind of dark. And I was interested in identity and men and what where we are, who we look up to, how are we supposed to behave now? There's no model for us. And I just kept digging back further and further and finding that there's never been a model. And I was really most interested in that character of Don. That's the germ of the idea.
My guest is Matthew Weiner. He's the creator of the AMC series Mad Men, and he's also written and directed episodes of the series. And in a moment, we'll be hearing from two of the stars of the show, John Hamm and John Slattery. Let's hear a scene that you wrote, Matthew, that features John Hamm in the leading role as Don Draper, and Don Draper's the main character of the series. Why don't you describe Don instead of me doing it?
Don Draper is a self-made man who is from a humble and somewhat horrible background. And he has come to New York in a very winding way and ended up a success. And he still carries that person inside him, and it informs him every day of his life. And it makes it hard for him to make lasting relationships and to have a strong marriage and to trust himself in a way. But at the same time, he's very curious and very interested in people. And I think that even though he behaves badly a lot of times, he does behave in a very moral way with each individual that he deals with.
The last episode of season one has one of my favorite moments from the series. And this is an episode, Matthew, that you wrote and directed. And in this episode, Don Draper has put together a presentation for one of the clients that they're trying to land, and it's Kodak. And Kodak has this new slide and slide projection system where the slides are all on a wheel, and they're calling it the wheel. And Draper's pitching them an ad campaign and a concept for the ad campaign. And in the scene midway through his pitch, he starts showing slides. And the slides happen to be slides of his own family moments, some of his most warm family moments, him nuzzling with his wife when they were younger, one of his children when they were an infant, really nostalgic scenes like that. And in the meantime, his own family life is actually in a lot of trouble. So I'd like you to talk about writing this scene, why you chose the slides as, you know, this, like, slide carousel as the object you wanted to write the ad campaign for, and if you had to get permission from Kodak to do it.
We did not get Kodak's permission, although it's an amazing ad for a product that no one's interested in anymore. What happened is that I knew that I wanted to tell this story about nostalgia, and I knew that I wanted to show that Don, the character, has realized that his brother, who has come back to him, has killed himself, and that he has estranged himself from his family, and he's there with his family slides. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to get this idea of nostalgia in there. And I actually, my advertising consultant, Josh Weltman, I'm like, I asked him, what came out that year? What can you find? And he comes in and he says, you're not going to believe this. And he mentions it to me because I always wanted Don to be showing personal pictures in this thing. I didn't know it could be a slide projector. I thought it might be a camera or something. And it was like an explosion in my brain when he told me about the carousel. And I was like, this is perfect.
So here's the scene from Mad Men featuring John Hamm as Don Draper. And remember, midway through this presentation, he's going to start showing slides from his own family moments.
My first job, I was in-house at a fur company with this old pro copywriter, Greek, named Teddy. And Teddy told me the most important idea in advertising is new. Creates an itch. You simply put your product in there as a kind of calamine lotion. But he also talked about a deeper bond with the product. Nostalgia. It's delicate, but potent. Sweetheart.
Teddy told me that in Greek, nostalgia literally means the pain from an old wound. It's a twinge in your heart, far more powerful than memory alone. This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine. Backwards, forwards. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. It's not called the wheel. It's called the carousel. Let's just travel the way a child travels. Round and around, and back home again. To a place where we know we are loved.
That's John Hamm as Don Draper in a scene from the AMC series Mad Men. And John Hamm, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you, Terry.
That's a great scene. You're so terrific in it. It's a really heartbreaking scene because your character knows he's having such trouble in his personal life as he's showing these wonderful slides and talking about nostalgia. John Hamm, tell us how you found out about this role. And first went on the audition for it.
It was, there's this mythical season in Los Angeles called pilot season. So I had gone out on several pilot auditions and gotten fairly far on them, and then something happened and I didn't get it. But this one script came, and I read it, and I thought, well, this is for AMC. They don't make television. They show old movies. But I read it, and I said, I have to be in this project at some point. I have to do something on this. This is so good. And I basically had to start at the very bottom. I was I didn't know the casting directors, and they didn't know me. So they wanted to do what's curiously called a pre-read with me, which is you meet the casting directors, and they read you and decide if they want to sort of take you to the next level. So I started literally at the very bottom of the process and worked my way up from there.
Matthew Weiner, why did you hire John Hamm in your leading role as Don Draper?
Well, first of all, there's something that John is leaving out, which people may not know, which is that audition. When you get to a certain point in your career, you really don't expect to audition even anymore. And certainly for a leading role like that, you do expect it. But there's really a hierarchy of who has to audition and what it is. And this thing was so important to me that I was like, I will not hire anybody who won't audition. So everyone had to audition. And the casting directors knew that. And they knew that John was the guy. And they wanted him to be perfect when I saw him. And what happened was he came in and literally his first audition, he left. And I said, that's the guy. He has this incredible intelligence. And you could see it right away. He understood everything that was going on there without any direction. And he had this presence that was both, it was an old-fashioned leading man quality. You don't even see these people anymore. You know, there's many more guys like Seth Rogen getting the girl, you know, nowadays than like John Hamm. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I'm much more of a Seth Rogen type. But in my fantasy, you know, of who this man was, and I told them I wanted James Garner. You know, and they're like, well, you know, he can't play it. And John came in, and there's also a depth to John. There's something about his eyes and his intelligence that I just felt, well, this is not a glib ad man. This is a man who has lived, who's an adult, who has some secrets, who has a heart, who understands women. I felt all of that from just watching him audition the very first time. And it was a matter of just trying to sell this person who was not famous as the star of the show. And I can say quite honestly, and John knows this too, that I basically told them that I would not do the show if John was not the lead.
I want to bring John Slattery into the conversation. And John Slattery plays Roger Sterling, who is the son of the late co-founder of the advertising agency Sterling Cooper. So now he's, you know, like one of the partners of it. And he's of a generation, like one generation older than Don Draper in the series. And in this scene, I'm going to play a scene with Roger Sterling and Don Draper. So in this scene, Sterling has just walked into Draper's office with a bottle of liquor and is sitting down, and they're kind of comparing generational differences. And the scene starts with John Slattery as Roger Sterling.
I bet daily friendship with that bottle attracts more people to advertising than any salary you could dream of.
Why I got in.
So enjoy it.
Doing my best here.
Oh, you're not. You don't know how to drink, your whole generation. You drink for the wrong reasons. My generation, we drink because it's good. Because it feels better than unbuttoning your collar. Because we deserve it. We drink because it's what men do.
What about shaky hands? I see a lot of that too with you boys.
No joke. Your kind, with your gloomy thoughts and your worries, you're all busy licking some imaginary wound.
Not all imaginary.
Yeah, boo-hoo.
Maybe I'm not as comfortable being powerless as you are.
Pardon?
That's John Hamm and John Slattery in a scene from Mad Men. John Slattery, welcome to the conversation.
Thanks, Terry.
How did you find out about Mad Men, and how did you end up auditioning for it?
I was in New York doing a play, and I was sent the script, and I've said this before, and Matt hasn't corrected me, so I'm going to stick with this version, which is that I read it thinking that they needed the character of Don Draper, which I was, of course, very happy about. I thought, you know, usually it's some 65-year-old guy that they send me a script for. So I prepared the part of Don Draper.
This is because your hair is gray, right?
That's right. That's among other things. So I worked on it and went in and read with Matt and Alan Taylor, who directed the pilot. I think I'd gone through it maybe twice. I think they actually had me go through it again before telling me, here's the thing. We have that guy. We want you to play this other guy, of which there was not as much.
Well, I hate to tell John this on the air. Beth Bowling and Kim Misha are casting directors. I wanted him to play Roger from the beginning, and they told me there was no way he would come in and read for that part. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, get him in here. And he came in and started reading Don, and it was a surprise to me too. And all I did was keep working with him as I figured out, like, how do I tell him I want him to play this other part, which was really, for a man much older than John. But I brought it down to a different age, and you know, the tough part was not just getting John to do the pilot, but afterwards just telling him, promising him, which I guess people do a lot in show business, mm-hmm. but promising him that I would take care of this character and that he was very important to me.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the AMC series Mad Men, which made TV history last night when it became the first basic cable series to win an Emmy for Outstanding Dramatic Series. Mad Men is set in the early 1960s at a Madison Avenue advertising agency. My guests are two stars of the series. John Hamm plays Don Draper. John Slattery plays Roger Sterling. Also with us is the show's creator, Matthew Weiner, who won an Emmy for Outstanding Writing for a Drama Series for the show's pilot. Here's the opening scene from the pilot. Ad man Don Draper is in a bar, talking to his waiter, asking why he smokes Old Gold cigarettes.
But what is it? I mean, Lothar, those new filters, why, I mean, why Old Gold?
They gave them to us in the service, a carton a week for free.
So you're used to them, is that it?
Yeah, they're a habit.
So I could never get you to try another brand, say, my Luckies.
I love my Old Golds.
All right, well, let's just say tomorrow a tobacco weevil comes and eats every last Old Gold on the planet.
That's a sad story.
It's a tragedy. Would you just stop smoking?
I think I could find something. I love smoking.
I love smoking. That's very good.
My wife hates it. Reader's Digest says it will kill you.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Ladies love their magazines.
Yes, they do.
Let me ask both Johns how you got in character for the period. What did you look at? What did you, what movies, if any, or TV shows did you watch, or ads, to just to get immersed in the early 60s?
Well, I had always sort of been a fan of that period and the art and the literature and the cinema that came out of it. You know, anything in the sort of Jack Lemmon, Walter Matthau crowd, and of course the Billy Wilder movies. And just on a more personal level, my father was sort of a big deal businessman in St. Louis in this time, in the 50s and 60s. And he worked for a company that his grandfather and his father had owned. So I literally just looking through old photo albums, and I could see, I mean, here was this guy, this man who was the sort of master of his domain, and the sort of ease which with he moved through this world. St. Louis is obviously a much smaller pond than Madison Avenue in New York City, but that kind of largesse and ease was a big part of what informed my interpretation of Don.
I got to ask you a question about that. Your character of Don has a way of kind of crossing his legs. It's a kind of power position for him. The way he crosses his legs is like, I own extra space around me. I own all the space around my body. Did your father kind of sit that way?
Yeah, he was a big guy. He was about 6'3", and he owned the space he was in. He was very friendly, very gregarious, very fun, very funny guy, but he also had a lot of sadness in his life. My father met my mother, who was a secretary, and they got married, but my mother was my father's second wife. His first wife died at a very young age, and my mother, his second wife, also died at a very young age. So this is a man who had a tremendous amount of sadness for being in such a sort of powerful and elevated position in his life. He did have a lot of sadness, so I didn't have to look too far to find any kind of inspiration for this guy. And you know, my father passed away when I was 20, so it's a drag that he doesn't get a chance to see this, because I think he would really enjoy the result.
Yeah, that kind of thing is always heartbreaking. John Slattery, what about you? What did you look for inspiration to get into your character who lives in the early 60s?
I was actually born in 1962, so I don't firsthand remember the period, but my father was actually in the shoe business, and I remember that he would stay out and come home later, and the kids would all have eaten, and sort of like the Draper situation. You know, he'd come home from the office after the children had their dinner and were on their way to bed, and I mean, I just remember that time very vividly. And it's also on a practical sort of going to work day to day basis, the clothes that we're in, Janie Bryant's design. You know, you're cinched into these, in my case, 3-piece suits and smoking cigarettes and drinking cocktails, and it has a way of propping you up. You know, it's an exoskeleton, these clothes. And after a while, that sort of carriage that provides you takes on a life of its own, so that in another scene, when you're not as formally dressed, you're still standing as straight as you would normally.
Matthew, in the opening credits sequence for Mad Men, there's an animation of a man, like Don Draper, falling from the top of an office building, slowly falling past this building down to... And you think he's going to hit the ground, but instead he lands in this chair.
Right.
And it's kind of like a metaphor for Draper's life. But when you see it, at least when I see it, I can't help but think of September 11th with the images of people jumping out of this, out of this like burning skyscraper. And I wonder if you ever think about that when you see the opening credits.
You know what? Obviously, I did the opening credits almost 2.5 years ago, and I had this image of this man falling out the window because, you know, if we had done this if the show was on the air in 1960, they'd be talking about the stock market crash. When businessmen jump out of the window, it means something is wrong. And I did not want it to be part of September 11th, other than the way that is part of our consciousness, that something's wrong, and that this man is metaphorically in free fall. And that is that canyon of buildings, which are covered with images from his life and advertising, that's the world that he's falling through. And then you just see him, that this is going on in his mind in the end, and that he's sitting there in the pose of perfect confidence. And that's what I was interested in, was a psychological state. And it's funny that no matter how much you abstract that image, it's so powerful. And he's a modern man. He's got a suit on, and it's computer animation, and there's a lot about it that should technically distance you from it, but it doesn't. And to me, and the music is falling also. You know, that's that piece of music
is a descending
absolutely.
Line. Mm-hmm.
So for me, I wanted to introduce people to this character, and I only was allowed 30 seconds. The Sopranos opening titles are 1.5 minutes. And you can tell a whole story. So to me, I had to go to the graphic punch of that. And, the AMC is in New York. I lived in New York. I understand what this image means to people. This is part of the message of the show. It's unpleasant, and it reminds you of something. Why would you get rid of it from your arsenal? Is it in bad taste? It's an emotional response.
You know, one of the things I really like about Mad Men, about the way the lives of the characters are portrayed, is that most of the men in the series seem so unhappy with their home lives. The main characters, like especially Don Draper, has a very attractive wife, but it seems that underneath, that he's living a conventional home life, cheating on the side, but he's not a conventional guy. But he wouldn't know how to lead an unconventional family life because it kind of wasn't done, or he thinks it wasn't done.
That's true, and it really wasn't done. But you know, what's conventional? I mean, and who looks at themselves in the mirror when they're married and they have kids and says, "Oh, I'm leading a conventional life." I mean, my inspiration for writing this piece, the first moment of interaction with really where Don was I was 35 years old. I had a job on a network sitcom that was rated number 9. Which means I was basically in Major League Baseball for my job. There's 300 people in the country that have this job, and I had one. I had 3 children, and I was like, what? This incredible wife, I was like, what is wrong with me? Why am I unhappy? Why is there so much going on in my head that I can't express to other people because it's all awful? And what is enough? And I'm going to die one day, and I'm looking at it and saying, this is it? It could be an excuse to behave very badly. It could be something. So, I mean, I look at these men and the women, too. We all have moments of alienation and private unhappiness, and no one is as happy as you think they are on the outside. And then there's moments of great joy in the show also.
Well, Matthew, I have to ask you, do you feel, now that you're working on a show that you created, do you feel happier and more fulfilled than you did when you were on the number 9 TV show and felt that underneath it all, there was a lot of dissatisfaction?
Well, the dissatisfaction drove me. And actually, with all the amazing things that have happened this year and happened to the show, I'm terrified that if I sit back and absorb it and enjoy it, I'm not going to be able to work anymore. I was driven by rage and resentment and listen to me and how come you're not listening to me? And now I kind of feel like people are listening. Actually, to tell you the truth, I feel amazing about things. I feel what I always want to feel from my work, which is that I'm communicating with other people and in an intimate way.
Well, I want to thank you all for talking with us, and congratulations on the show. Thanks very much, John Slattery, John Hamm, and Matthew Weiner.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks, Terry.
It's very exciting. Thanks.
Matthew Weiner is the creator of the AMC series Mad Men, which won the Emmy last night for Best Dramatic Series. John Hamm and John Slattery star in the series. Our interview was recorded last Thursday. The Emmy Awards were broadcast last night on ABC, honoring the best in television for the 2007-2008 TV series. It was a season hampered by a writer's strike and, as the statuettes were handed out, dominated by cable. Tonight, broadcast TV tries to get back on track and attract attention and viewers by launching the new fall season. Our TV critic David Bianculli looks back at last night's Emmys and ahead to the new season.
A lot of really good shows were given Emmys last night. But what struck me the most, as the night went on, was the dominance of cable TV and how few people actually are watching the shows that won the major awards. One big winner was HBO's John Adams, with 5 major Emmys. That's no surprise. It was an excellent miniseries. And cable, particularly HBO, has dominated the TV movies and miniseries category for a long time now. But drama series? If broadcast TV is supposed to have a wheelhouse, weekly series drama is it. But look what happened last night. In the top drama categories, the AMC cable network got Best Drama for Mad Men and Best Actor for Bryan Cranston of Breaking Bad. Glenn Close won as Best Actress for the FX drama Damages. Add up the viewers for all 3 of those shows, and you wouldn't have enough to crack the top 50. Over on the comedy side, NBC managed a clean sweep of the biggest awards, thanks to 30 Rock, which won 5, including Best Comedy Series and Best Actor and Actress for Alec Baldwin and Tina Fey. The Emmy voters deserve credit for their support of 30 Rock, which was last season's best comedy. But TV viewers don't get credit for their support, or lack of it. Even though it was on broadcast TV, 30 Rock wasn't a top 10 show last season, or a top 20 show, or even a top 40 show. It didn't even crack the top 100. And it really, really pains me to point this out, but 30 Rock, on average, was seen by fewer viewers last season than ABC's Cavemen. So what you had last night was a celebration of shows that most people aren't watching, and most of which don't come from broadcast TV. The only Emmys won last night by CBS, once known as the Tiffany Network, were for its reality shows, The Amazing Race and Survivor. That is not a good sign. Neither is it a good sign that the Emmy show last night, televised by ABC, was so timid. Anytime anyone started to say anything even remotely political, the orchestra started to drown them out or cut them off entirely. Listen to what happened to Kirk Ellis, who won for writing the HBO miniseries adaptation of John Adams. He was cut off in mid-sentence by an announcer, just as he was getting started.
I've got to dedicate this award to 2 people. My own Abigail Adams, my partner, my wife, Sheila, and David McCullough, not only a great historian, but a great dramatist. I'm proud to call him a friend as well as a mentor. Thank you, Tom Hanks, Gary Getzman, Michael Lombardo, Colin Callender, for giving me this amazing opportunity to talk about a period in our history when articulate men articulated complex thoughts in complete sentences. They used words.
The Amazing Race, American Idol, Dancing with the Stars, Project Runway, Top Chef. Who will take home the Emmy for reality competition program? It's next, here on the Emmys.
Yeah, they used words, but Kirk Ellis wasn't given the chance to. Look, it's a good thing that so much wealth is spread around the TV spectrum. But if broadcast TV can't compete with the cable big boys, can't draw viewers to its own best shows, and doesn't even have the nerve to make its live awards shows lively, then you have to ask yourself, what can it do well? This week, it tries to show us by launching what looks like a traditional fall TV season. Except it isn't, because the writer's strike of last year cut back development and production of new series. The best fall series of the ones I've seen, the Fox show Fringe, premiered 2 weeks ago. This week, the official launch week of the 2008-09 TV season, there are only five more new ones. Two are worth sampling. Tonight's CBS sitcom Worst Week, and tomorrow's CBS drama The Mentalist. But neither really excites me, or deserves more notice than that. What does deserve notice? That the old good shows are returning, finally, with new episodes. Tonight, we get the season premieres of Heroes on NBC, How I Met Your Mother on CBS, and Boston Legal on ABC. Later this week, we get a bunch. Ugly Betty and The Office, The Simpsons and 60 Minutes, Desperate Housewives, and My Name is Earl. But even on broadcast TV's big week, cable isn't calling it quits. HBO launches two new series, including Little Britain USA, and Showtime presents the season premieres of two excellent shows, Dexter and Californication. Meanwhile, where is 30 Rock? NBC could have had the show ready for premiere week and poised to capitalize on its handful of new Emmys. But no. 30 Rock isn't starting its season until the 30th. October 30th. If you want to see Tina Fey before then, you'll have to watch the late night or special primetime editions of Saturday Night Live and hope she makes another appearance as Sarah Palin. And then, at least, mentioning politics won't get you cut off in mid-sentence.
David Bianculli is TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film studies at Rowan University. The crime novelist James Crumley died last week at the age of 68 after a period of declining health. We're going to listen back to an interview with Crumley. In his New York Times obit Saturday, Crumley was described as, quote, a critically acclaimed crime novelist whose drug-infused, alcohol-soaked, profanity-laced, breathtakingly violent books swept the hard-boiled detective from the Raymond Chandler era into an amoral, utterly dissolute, apocalyptic post-Vietnam universe, unquote. I spoke with Crumley in 1987 after three of his novels were reprinted by the Vintage Contemporary Fiction series. Two of them focused on his private eye, Milton Chester Milo Dragovich III, Milo to his friends. He's an ex-deputy sheriff turned private eye who's almost always drunk and broke as he waits to inherit the family fortune. The character lived in Montana, where Crumley lived. I asked James Crumley why he started writing detective novels.
I like the notion of being able to deal in some kind of murky world where the morality is not too clearly delineated, and but where there's some kind of sense of justice that you can reach at the end. It's usually an uncomfortable and certainly unsatisfying sense of justice, but it satisfies me.
There are certain conventions of the detective genre. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages for you as a writer to be writing within a genre?
I find more disadvantages than advantages. With the detective having to always be upright and forthright and honest and stern and steadfast and all of those things. And I think I've tried in all of the books to use a detective that's flawed in many of the same ways that the villains are flawed. And I think he even says occasionally that if he hadn't have been a cop, that he would have probably been a criminal. I guess the only real advantage to writing in a genre is that you can play off the genre. It's like everybody knows the rules, and so that you can do pretty much whatever you want to. As long as you admit the rules, you can break them.
I'm going to ask you to read a passage from the beginning of The Wrong Case.
Okay, that's sort of a tradition for the detective to sit around his office and describe it so that the people, so that the readers can get a sense of him. And this is Milton Chester Milo Dragovich is the third. This is his office. The large old-fashioned safe in the corner left from my grandfather's days as a banker was empty except for $2,000 of untaxed mad money. Age and sorrow, those were my only assets, my largest liabilities. But like most men who drank too much, I'd spent most of my life considering my dismal future, and it had stopped amusing me. So I had another drink and walked over to the north windows to look down upon the happy, employed folk of Merriweather. Once we Milo Dragoviches had been big stuff in this town, but now the only way I could look down on anybody was to climb up to my office, stare down from the windows. Lunch hour was done. People were hurrying about their business, driving back to office and store in air-conditioned cars, even though the air seemed more like spring than summer. I'd never owned an air-conditioned car, so I could feel vaguely smug. Until August, anyway.
Now, usually in detective novels, the characters' names are pretty short and simple. Philip Marlowe, Lou Archer. What did you do a Milo Dragovich for your detective?
It was a name that I'd run across. It's an old Montana name. And it's just stuck in my head. I couldn't get rid of it. And I just liked the sound of the name. And Milton Chester Milo Dragovich III.
Your detective says that he realized if he wasn't a cop, he'd probably be a crook.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're a writer who spends a lot of time at a desk, probably behind a typewriter, or at least with a pad on your lap. Do you feel at all drawn to that world of crooks and cops?
Well, yes. In some kinds of ways, too, I'm a child of the 60s, when everybody was a criminal, partially because of the marijuana laws and partially because of the politics in the protests. I know a lot of minor league criminals, I guess you could call them, and I have friends with several cops and ex-cops, and even know a few private detectives. So I find that world much more interesting, for instance, say, than the academic world, where I labored for 11 years at various universities all across the country. I think all writers feel in some kind of way outside of the mainstream of the worlds they live in. And I think most writers find themselves drawn to other people who are on the outside looking in. So I'm not sure whether it's a fascination with crime or whether it's a fascination with alienation.
How did you discover detective fiction?
underneath one of my aunt's mattresses when I was about 9 years old. In the first,
was it supposed to be dirty?
Well, it was Mickey Spillane, and it was pretty racy stuff for high school girls back then. I was still in grade school, and my aunts must have hid them for some reason, and so I read Mickey Spillane at an early age, and it wasn't until I was in the middle of my first novel that I went back to detective novels. A poet here in Montana, Richard Hugo, turned me on to Raymond Chandler. And I spent a summer working on my first novel in Mexico and reading all of Raymond Chandler's work, which is when I decided that I wanted to do at least one detective novel.
You grew up in Texas, and mm-hmm. You now live in Montana. So you've spent most of your life in the West. Did you grow up with a lot of cowboy stories, Westerns, things like that?
My great-grandfather was still alive when I was a little boy right after World War II, and he was one of the last of the Texas trail drivers and wagon train drivers to die. And so I picked up a lot of stories from him. My father worked in the oil field, however, and I grew up in company houses. And I read probably as much Western fiction when I was young as I did anything else except for science fiction. So I also went to the Western movies every Saturday while my mother was at the grocery store, go to a double feature at the It Theater in Mathis, Texas. And so I got all that cowboy stuff pretty good.
Your novels are just republished now in the Vintage Contemporary series. And I wonder if you think you're being rediscovered by new readers or publishers?
I don't remember being discovered the first time. So it's difficult to be rediscovered. It's nice to get to a broader kind of audience than people who go looking for my books. And I think they've given me a little more clout in the literary world, if one needs clout in the literary world, to be in this series with the writers who are considered serious writers, Tom McGuane, Ray Carver, etc. But sometimes I wish I was in a you know, in the smaller paperback editions and more widely distributed in truck stops and supermarkets and 7-Elevens.
With nice lurid covers?
Absolutely. I think that's where my audience... I think that's where my audience is. One of the things that has always encouraged me and made me feel good about the books that I write is that working class people read them and are moved by them. And you know, my background is firmly rooted in the lower middle classes, working classes, and I still remember what work was like. Although I'm certainly glad I don't have to do it anymore. I do have a great deal of respect for those people, and when they like my books, I'm particularly tickled.
James Crumley, recorded in 1987. He died last Wednesday at the age of 68. His crime novels include The Wrong Case and The Last Good Kiss.